AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Off the ball, rugby.
The big shot from Sam Prendergast on James O'Connor. Like we've talked a lot ad nauseum around his physicality. If it's there once, it's there multiple times.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the ball daily.
Now then, I think it's fair to say it's one of the sports books of the year. It's Sacrifice, A Year in the Life of a Champion Jockey by Oisin Murphy. Once again, champion jockey. How are you getting on? Congratulations. You're welcome to studio.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's great to be here.
I must say, I was thinking to myself, you know, and I think this is a bit of a dangerous question to start off with. I could almost start by saying this is a quiet time in your life. Things kind of die down in November, December for a flat jockey, but I think that'd be a stupid thing to say to you. There's always something going on.
Yeah, it's still a busy time, but I don't have to ride every day. I have trips to Saudi Arabia, Hong Kong and India coming up before Christmas. But it's definitely an enjoyable time of year from the point of view. I can go to a few soccer matches and go show jumping and feel like I have some free time.
Your team is Chelsea.
Yeah.
Indeed. So you get to the bridge a bit?
I won't travel up to Burnley to watch them on Saturday, but I think the following week I'll get to a home game.
And where would you take into show jumping then?
So the show jumping, I've always had horses with Irish riders, and there's a tour down in Spain at the moment in Oliva. It's hard because they tend to jump Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I can never get away for 4 days. But I was just talking before I got on air. I'm hoping to get down a weekend or two before those foreign trips in the Middle East from Saudi, India and Hong Kong or the other way around. But yeah, I'm trying to juggle all these balls so I don't feel like I'm missing out.
Yeah. When was the last day off you had?
With like a chill day.
Yeah, a chill day where the world of horses doesn't enter your sphere.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure.
Because you describe some of your days off in the book, and then they just become these explorations of what are you going to do next. Like you might ride out a small bit, or you might go and watch a horse race, or as you say, go and take in some show jumping. You're always thinking about the future, if not today.
Yeah, I love horses genuinely. I was hunting this week. I tend to spend a lot of time on top of horses, you can imagine, for a jockey, but I do have other things going on as well. I do love the football. I obviously, like you, follow the GAA, and yeah. We're very proud of the exploits of Kerry, and you know, I try and balance the life, but I ride in like so many countries every year and 1,000 horses a year. It's hard to get that work-life balance.
Not to put a quote back to you from the book, but on page 222, you say the following. I can officially confirm that 2024 will be my last championship, at least for a few years, but probably forever. What happened?
Right. So I was suspended in 2022 and I came back and in 2023, I tried very hard to win the championship, but I had some whip suspensions and careless riding suspensions, so I missed 40 days of the season. So anyway, I damaged my chances of winning the championship in 23. I finished second. In 24, I had a point to prove, because I'd won it 3 times before, but not since 2021. And we got through 2024 and it took so much out of me. I really didn't enjoy the process, most days anyway. You know, for all I might have days where I ride winners, I'm not always, or don't always feel like I've ridden that well. That kind of self-critical side of me is at an all-time high. And in 2025, I promised that I'd enjoy it a bit more. But of course, as is well publicised, I dug a huge hole for myself towards the end of April this year, before the season got going, I crashed a car drunk. And fortunately for me and my passenger, we were both absolutely fine. But, you know, there could have been grave consequences. I could have killed both of us. And I felt the season was beginning the very next weekend. So I crashed the car on the Saturday night. The following Saturday, the season began, and I just felt like I had to try and win the championship again, because people will expect, you know, Oisin Murphy's finished. He won't come back from this. So I put a lot of pressure on myself to achieve again this year. And fortunately, it's the best I ever rode at statistically. You know, again, it's a roller coaster ride. There were plenty of days where I feel like I'm not riding well. Why didn't I win on that horse? But there were some good days as well.
Wow. So the events of earlier this year inspired you on to actually winning this year's championship, and you almost realigned your goals for 2025 as a result of that.
Yeah, they certainly did. You know, I probably... Oh, and I'll tell you, I have battled alcohol not in my teens, but since probably 2017, so from my early 20s until now. And I've had periods of sobriety and periods where I've tried to drink like a normal fella or a gentleman, or just have a few drinks. And for all there was some success at that, I caused huge problems as well. And you know, I'm solely responsible for them. And it wasn't until the end of April this year that I finally realized that, you know, I've this tried and tested thing of me thinking I can drink responsibly has failed. And I just had to realize that my life with alcohol in it is unmanageable, and the fallout of me drinking is unbearable to deal with. And you know, I think the reason I rode better than ever this year was because I was sober.
Wow. How used to you drink? What would be a standard evening of alcohol consumption?
From the time I got in the car, so I'm always driven round because I'm at so many meetings and riding so many horses. So I've had a full-time driver since 2015. I would text my driver asking, can I have a bottle of vodka for the drive home? And then whatever that journey would be, whether it's an hour or five, I would get home alone and drink more on the sofa. And that was a daily thing. And yes, there were periods of sobriety. One went on for 18 months, but I held on to that idea that one day I'm going to learn to drink responsibly, or learn to drink like a normal fella and have a few pints. I even changed my drinking habits. I basically tried and almost succeeded and stopped drinking vodka, and I started drinking bottles of beer. You know, the end goal or the end result was the same. And, you know, it brought me a lot of bad press, a lot of stress. But I was the author of that book, you know.
Because in the book, you're sober and you're talking about being very self-aware about what would happen if you were to take a drink. When do you make the, like, it's not a decision, it's just something that happens, I'd imagine. When does that finish for you, and when do you get back on to drink after this book?
Yeah, I remember Christmas last year into New Year's, February, periods of March. I remember blacking out numerous times, and it just escalated very quickly, you know, with the best intention in the world. I thought I was going to have one or two drinks, and I wake up the next morning not knowing how I got to bed, you know. And that scared me a little bit, but it clearly didn't do enough, because I found myself behind the wheel of a car, you know, drunk, on April 26th.
One thing that's very clear about you is that you're an unbelievably self-aware person. And I'm not sure, is it because of those brushes with, you know, near tragedy or whatever the case may be? Maybe it's the therapy that you're very open about in the book as well, and talk about some of the messages that your therapist has given you. Were you always that way, or is it really just a consequence of some of the life events that you've gone through? Like, were you always that self-critical and self-analytical?
Perhaps, because I knew in order for me to live my dream and become a jockey and hopefully do it as a job, that I was going to have to be A, very lucky, B, work very hard, and C, you know, I was going to need some luck.
Yeah.
And you know, I never ever thought as a child or a young adult that I was any better than anyone else. In fact, I knew when I went to Andrew Boulding's, there were 9 other apprentices. So there are 10 young boys ranging in age from 16 to 20 that want to be future jockeys competing for the same rides. And on the mechanical horse, I looked the worst on them. You know, right. Although I might ride nicely out on the gallops or whatever, the pushing and the use of the whip and whatever, I wasn't any good. And it just took a lot of hard work to get going. And fortunately, it kind of, my career did take off. But even now, you know, people might think, well, that guy's flying and he's had so many winners this week. But I'm quick to remind them, well, I got beat on, you know, 5 favourites yesterday, and on a good day I might have won on a few of them. Do you know what I mean?
There's a balance there between staying humble, and I've no doubt that you're naturally a very humble person, but balancing that between, and then also the fact that you need to lower your expectations in the world of flat racing, because I presume the percentage of what you win versus what you lose, the losing far outweighs the winning. So it's a balancing of those two things. But you refer obviously to your self-destruct button in the book. You talk about guilt being quite a damaging emotion for you. And then you say you're often affected by pangs of self-doubt. Mm. And the self-doubt for me is almost the most interesting of that list of characteristics that you identified there, because of the success that you've had. Do you still have those pangs of self-doubt?
Sure, sure. Because we have short memories as humans, or certainly I do. You know, my memory was so short that I convinced myself for years and years that the incidents I caused drinking weren't going to reoccur. And, you know, I obviously have periods in the saddle where things are going very well. I'm leading rider at this meeting or that meeting. I win a big race. But, you know, 3 days later, that's all forgotten about, and I'm looking towards the next weekend and what group ones I have coming up. And, you know, I tell you what the main thing is as well. There are times in the year in the saddle that I feel like I am riding very well. It's like I'm instinct driven. I have a connection with the horse. I didn't leave any races behind me. But I never know when those periods are going to come. And sometimes, you know, they're few and far between. And, you know, the last 6 weeks of the championship season this year, I had 3 4 timers at Kempton, Salisbury and Doncaster, and my routine hadn't changed, but you know, those periods are what I kind of yearn for, and that's probably what I get most enjoyment out of. It doesn't matter if I get, you know, some praise on social media or television, or really what big races I win. I only get praise from within, and you know, that's when things go kind of perfectly.
That's really interesting, because I understand that when it comes to you being crowned champion jockey and the whole pomp and ceremony around that, when you get presented with the trophy and everybody's there to celebrate you, those moments don't give you the same level of enjoyment.
No, none. In fact, I feel uncomfortable, and you know, there's a lot going on that day as well on Kip Kobe's Champions Day, because you have 5 group ones or 6 group ones on the day. So I don't want it to detract from my racing day and trying to perform in the saddle. You know, the proof is in the pudding, really. This season I rode the highest ever strike rate I've done, so like 24%. You know, I'm still losing 3 out of every 4 races, but I believe the reason this year was better than the others statistically is because I was sober, you know. And I've spoken about it recently, but my memory has recovered you know, if you and I had a chat in the street about something of no consequence within the last week, it's likely I'd remember it. I had done such damage to my brain in the past, I couldn't tell you what I did yesterday, you know, and that's a motivating factor as well in staying sober, you know. I only have to walk into an AA meeting and you see people coming back from relapses like I've had to do in the past, and it's frightening, and no one is safe from an addiction. If they stop working at it, that devil on their shoulder will drive them back down the path they don't want to be.
It's worth understanding why that is, and I know there's a family story there, but there's also the story of what you do for a living, which I think explains a part of it. I'm not sure what your theory is, but you cite a 2021 British Medical Journal study into the mental health difficulties of pro jockeys. So the results of that, jockeys reported higher levels of depressive and anxiety symptoms compared with other athletes. I might actually just read the page out because it's really, really interesting stuff which I actually hadn't read before. So higher levels of depressive and anxiety symptoms compared with other elite athletes, substance misuse and in particular excessive alcohol use also appeared greater among jockeys than other elite athletes. It went on to say that risk factors for mental health difficulties include injury, perceived stress, athlete burnout, career dissatisfaction and the contemplation of retirement, and that weight making negatively impacts jockeys' mood and attitudes towards eating, with lower competitive riding weights associated with more disordered eating attitudes. Moreover, help seeking from mental health professionals appears low. When you read that, does that all ring true to you?
Yeah, it does. It does, and yes, it probably contributes to it contributed to my relationship with alcohol, but I can't blame it. You know, I drank because I liked the feeling it gave me. I liked the escape that it allowed me, and yeah, and you know, to say that I drank because I'm have to waste every day would be lies. You know, the very beginning of my career in 2013, 2014, I didn't drink at all. And I was killing myself with weights. I was taking off like 7 pounds some mornings, and working very hard, riding out and, you know, doing all the usual duties that people can read about in the book. The roller coaster ride of being a jockey certainly will contribute to someone's mental health, you know, because one day when you have good horses to ride, you're achieving and doing well. And the next day when you don't have good horses to ride, it doesn't matter how talented you are, you can't achieve. And I suppose there are a lot of knockbacks in racing, you know. Of course, you dream and yearn to ride the best horses, but only one person can. And yeah, we have a great support system there. But as you well know, support is only useful to people that want it.
You do cite a couple of tragic instances as well in terms of suicide and it being a huge issue really in the jockey community. You mention Michael Byrne, who died at the age of 36, and then a couple of his close friends took their own lives a couple of years before Michael Byrne, Liam Treadwell and James Banks, who died by suicide in 2020. And the commonality between them is that they were recently retired, and that transition in your career, it's very evidently an unbelievably difficult job, but then that transition to retirement seems to be even more difficult.
Yeah, and a young jockey called Tommy Jakes is being buried today. He took his own life a fortnight ago or 3 weeks ago. You know, I knew him quite well, and I would have never guessed that he was struggling. And you just never know what people are going through. It's very, very sad. It's one of the saddest things, I must say. You know, a young life with so much more to give. The family that person leaves behind and how they cope with it. You know, I genuinely don't know the answers. I didn't think Tommy Jakes was going to take his own life, and here we are.
That last piece of the passage that I read out a moment ago talks about there being a lower case of people seeking help from professionals. What persuaded you to seek help?
Oh, I knew that I knew I couldn't do it alone, and I needed specific services. I had a great therapist or counsellor, and they helped, but it didn't distinguish the feeling of feeling alone in the way that my drinking, I thought I was the only person who drank the way I did, you know. I couldn't find a I couldn't find anyone around me that I felt could understand my drinking. And it wasn't until I went to AA and actually listened to what people had to say that I realized there's a whole room full of people like me. And, you know, the meetings are key. No one is safe from relapse. It doesn't matter how many, what their length of sobriety is. You know, if you stop going to meetings and stop working at the program, chances are you're an open goal for relapse. And I was in a meeting in London recently, and an Irish fella was chairing, and he was like a movie star, like someone you'd see straight off the television. And one line really stood out for me. He spoke for about 10 minutes, and he said, "Life is still shit, but if I pick up a drink, it'll be a lot shitter." And that resonated with me, because obviously people see me riding on television and flying all over the world to ride, and it appears, the outsider looking in, that I have a great life. And yes, it's the life I dreamed about, but there are still some bad moments and bad days. And, you know, the key is, if I go back on the drink, however bad I'm feeling today or yesterday or next week, it'll be 10 times worse. And that's not an exaggeration.
This is not the most important question about alcoholism, but one thing that came into my mind is, how did you maintain the weight, especially if you switched to the bottles of beer?
Yeah, do you know what? I was heavier this year than I had been in previous seasons. And I think it's because I have more of an appetite now sober than I had done on the drink. And when I had done the long period sober before, I hadn't been race riding all the way through. So like from the end of 2021 all the way through to early 2023 and longer. But I didn't have to get on the scales every day, so I don't quite know what weight I got to.
Right.
But like when I was drinking on the way home from the races every day, I just didn't have dinner. I just kept drinking the vodka, you know, so.
Right, that probably is less, fewer calories in vodka than there is in your steamed fish or whatever it was. How many calories on average do you consume a day?
I reckon about 1,200.
How many calories should a normal person of your height be?
I'm not that big.
I presume 2,000 at least, though.
Yeah, I am a leprechaun, so maybe 1,800.
One of the passages, again, like this is 25th of April 2024, on the way to Beverly Races. "I probably won't eat now before this evening, and all I've had today so far is 300 millilitres of water and no coffee. I'll probably drink another 200 millilitres before I get to Beverly. I know it must sound bonkers, us having to measure out what we drink, but water is weight at the end of the day. My meal this evening, by the way, will consist of some oranges and a few grapes."
Mm.
That is bleak.
Yeah. Yeah, and like that trip to Beverly is a long way. It's at least 4.5 hours each way. But yeah, that's what some days are like. You know, and they're not the days where you get lots of plaudits on television or social media. But if you do want to win the Jockeys Championship, they're the most important days, because they build up. You know, and if I can ride two winners at Beverly that day and two at Salisbury the next and two at Newcastle the day after, they make a huge difference when it comes to the jockey's title race.
Because there's another meeting in Florida that you mentioned, which occurs in December, which I presume you have your hair down a little bit more season-wise around that, where you have to drop 10 pounds in the space of 36 hours, going from 9 stone 2 pounds to 8 stone 6 pounds.
Yeah, I had been in New York for Christmas with my ex-girlfriend, sober, and thought it was lovely. Didn't feel that heavy. You know, I had been in the gym a little bit, not killing myself, but exercising, and cautious enough of what I was eating. And I got to Florida, and I think I was about 9 stone 2. And it was either the next day or the day after, I had 8 stone 6. So I had 10 pounds to lose. And yeah, I did it, but I didn't feel great, I must say.
How would you have gone about doing that now?
I had to run sweatsuit, and I broke it up, but like running sweatsuit on into the beach to feel normal again. I stayed in an apartment in an apartment beside the sea, hot tub for a while, read a book in the hot tub. Don't try and sweat too quickly because mind over matter, you just die and cave in. Bath, walk to the races, sauna, out, just loads of blankets and towels, back into the sauna, and yeah, I just broke it up.
The first time you had to go through something like that, I'd imagine it's a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah, it was. The first time I had to do that was my first race ride in England, which would have been like April, May 2013. And I remember when the ride came through, I was like 8 stone 7, and it had 8 stone. So I actually lost 7 pounds for my first ever ride. And yeah, that was torture. And I had to do those sort of lightweights kind of all throughout that first season or two, race riding. And I wanted to do those lightweights because I was so keen to ride and get experience and get my career going. You know, this is everything I'd worked towards. Even the subjects I picked at school were to help me be a jockey later on.
Really?
Yeah.
What subject?
Well, German, French, biology, geography, business.
Because you wanted to be a show jumper.
Exactly.
You still do.
Well, I want to be a good amateur.
And what about National Hunt?
No, I have decided I'm not going to be the next Ruby Walsh or Davy Russell. Yeah.
More money in the flat, says they.
Well, that's what they'd say, but I can tell you now, they had very good careers.
Yeah, oh, absolute legends of the game. Sorry, not to go back to the weight thing again, but it is fascinating because, like, we and you refer to it as wasting. It does strike me that at this stage of your career, certainly when you're in season, that you have, especially now that you've kicked the bottle, that you have a good control over it. That so, like, not to, it sounds like an awful phrase to use, but it kind of sounds like you're wasted. That yeah. You're in a constant state of being under your actual
weight. A bit dehydrated and things.
Do you get used to that?
Yeah,
being wasted, is that a state of mind?
No, you do. You get used to just being dehydrated every day, and the hunger pangs disappear. You know, I haven't eaten today, I don't feel hungry. You know, it hasn't entered my mind, and that's kind of the process. I didn't have to get up this morning and, you know, hold my breath when I got on the scales, you know,
which is... You hold the breath going on the scales?
Sometimes you would be, as you're thinking, God, you know, I ate too much yesterday and I was already heavy yesterday, and today I've got 8.8. This is going to be torture, you know what I mean?
Are you worried about your relationship with food?
Not really, because so obviously I've been suspended a lot in my career, but during those suspension periods, I have tried to, you know, have eating habits like a normal person.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a bit heavier and I couldn't fit in some of my clothes, but I didn't become a complete Oompa Loompa. I think I'll be okay.
So we'll pull the curtain back on this. So it is 12:40 p.m. on a Friday afternoon. You'll be hearing this probably a week later. You're on the Late Late Show tonight. You haven't eaten today. So what will your consumption look like? Because you've got a late one tonight as well. I presume you won't be going to bed anytime before midnight.
No, I don't actually. I struggle to sleep early in the evening. But yeah, I'll have some lunch this afternoon, like some grapes and oranges. And then
that's your lunch.
Yeah, but I quite like that. And
they are nice, but as a full meal.
Yeah, and we might have some steak later. You know, I love, you know, around here there's lots of restaurants and just comes out a big lump of beef.
Just beef? Do you have sides?
Probably not. You know, you have to remember as well, in Ireland we're very generous with portion sizes.
Yes.
So it could end up being quite plentiful.
It's absolutely fascinating. Not to kind of like bring it back down like a grim path again, but when you're talking about your alcoholism there and you speak about it so honestly, and brilliantly, and then you speak about maybe the underwhelming moment of Champion Jockey Day and all that sort of stuff. What's the thing that gives you most happiness at this stage in your life?
Oh, that's a good one. I think I've been in a pretty good mood for the last few weeks. I got a great kick out of winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf for Donegh O'Brien, and it felt like an Irish winner, although she's owned by American people. Those sort of moments, and being able to have a laugh with some friends or family, and being able to remember them, you know, because when I was drinking, I didn't remember a lot. And I snigger as I say that, but, you know, I really damaged my brain. I enjoy watching the football.
Yeah.
I was, and the rugby, and the soccer. Yeah, it's a different life, you know, because in the past, I just couldn't imagine doing those sort of things without drinking. You know, I haven't told this story before, but James Doyle is a very good friend of mine, really, really good jockey, was retained by Judd Monk at Dolphin, and now Watnan has had every big job in racing. He's a few years older. And I remember during the COVID pandemic, he told me he was giving up drink during COVID. And I couldn't comprehend why anyone who's now out of work wouldn't find this opportunity to go really hard on the drink. And of course, he stopped drinking, and I upped my drinking, and I, you know, cemented an already compounding relationship with alcohol, and he's maintained a friendly relationship with alcohol, and yeah, it just goes to show how sick I was, you know. I really struggled to understand why someone wouldn't use that time to drink daily.
Would you, if you ever had kids, advise them to get into racing?
Oh, good question. I think it depends completely on them. You know, I was never pushed towards it. I would have been...
You were shown your uncle winning Grand Nationals, Gold Cups.
Yeah, but I think I'd have been supporting whatever I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to think if I was a father, I'd be the same. Of course, it'd be nice if they rode ponies and things. It would give me a purpose. I'd be very happy if they wanted to play rugby for Ireland as well, you know?
I mean, we established this before you came into studio. You're from the same part of the world as I am. In fact, you would have played for the... If you were to play Gaelic Games, you'd have played for the same club as me.
Yes.
You're 1 year younger than me, so we would have literally been on the same team. If you just got your act together and laced up a pair of boots, where were you? We were playing 13-a-side.
Yeah, yeah, of course. We couldn't fill a team.
We couldn't fill a team. Well, I mean, the first I'd ever heard of Usheed Murphy was the guy's gone away and been an unbelievably successful jockey. So yeah, did we lose out in a good one?
No, I doubt it. I actually played... I went to secondary school in Cork, and I played for Botevant. And they were great times, but I'm not a skilled footballer. My hand-eye coordination isn't great.
When it comes to what's next for you, then, you mentioned in the book that the Prix de l'Arc is the one that you really want. You mentioned the enjoyment you get there out of the Breeders' Cup experience as well. I get the sense that actually the travel that comes with being a jockey and the opportunities that you have, especially on the flat, is something that is a scratch you'd like to itch a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky on international travels already, but the Arc is the one race. I mean, the Sunday in Paris, full of Irish, Japanese, all over the world, racing fans are tuning in. There was a special moment when Kieran Fallon won the Arc on Dylan Thomas, and he's being led back in. That ingrained in my memory as a child, and I don't know, I just found it hugely energising, and I got an adrenaline rush, and even now thinking about it, it brings back those feelings, and I'd love to achieve a victory in that race one day.
Well, Oisin, you've achieved so much already. I'm sure it gets said to you every single day, but you're an unbelievable Irish success story, and your success as a human being as you continue this journey through alcoholism is inspirational as well. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who read the book, who listen to these interviews and gain a whole pile from it. So very best of luck with what's next in that journey. And it's been a real privilege having you in here, Oisin. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Off the Ball Daily.